This week on Writers, Inc.
Idiotic thing that people tell writers. Show, don't tell. Have you ever read anything written by somebody who actually was showing you? Then he took his left foot and moved it forward. And you know, that's showing how to walk. But you don't do that. You say he got in the car and arrived at the bank in 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have to tell us how to operate the car or show us, you know, show, don't tell is crap.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc.
Welcome back, J.D.
I am jet lagged, dude. Like I was just, we were talking about it a little bit. Like I can't get back to normal. Like I keep waking up at like 3 a.m, which was 9 o'clock over in Amsterdam and that part of the world. But like I used to like recover in like a day, and for whatever reason, this one's just hanging in there. And then we're gonna have to leave for Vegas in a couple more days. That's what it is. Yeah, I think I'm getting too old for all this stuff. It was fun though.
Yeah. Send me a text. I'm usually up 3 a.m.
Wait, I'm checking your social media right now. Now, I don't know. I remember you said, I don't know, was it to everybody, but to me, the lineup to see you in Belgium, which was crazy. Why is that not on your social media?
Oh, yeah, I probably should put that up there, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a long line.
It was insane. Like, there were people that were there like 2 to 3 hours before I showed up, and like we signed, you know, I was signing for at least 3 hours, and like we kind of got to the end, but then more people kept queuing up. But like at one point, like I just had to leave. I had my first fainter, which was both cool and crazy scary at the same time. Like this girl just walked up and like, I just said hi, and like her eyes just rolled up in her head and she just fell over.
And like,
I get plenty of nervous people, and like, I get that, you know, like they're all shaking and they're like trying to take pictures and all that stuff. But I have never, ever had a fainter. And like, she felt so bad. Cause like, you know, she literally like tried to stand up like almost right away. And then they put her off in a corner and gave her some water and took care of her, brought her back to take a picture when she was feeling better. But yeah, it was nuts. I don't know how many people were in the line. There was 1,000 something that registered.
That's wild.
When I run into you in Vegas, I will faint.
We'll all faint. For you. We'll do
we'll
a
just
reenact.
Faint.
I get both. Like I literally just did a Barnes and Noble that I had maybe 15 people that showed up. So like you just never know. And like I was a little nervous. I mean, going to a foreign country. I've never been to Amsterdam and in Belgium and stuff for a book thing before. So I wasn't really sure what to expect, but it started coming together towards the, you know, like right before I left, and I knew it was looking decent.
I'm super curious, who sets this up? Like, how do you get all these interviews and book signings?
That was totally my publisher. They are all very organized when I go overseas. So they usually will have somebody just pick me up at the airport, you know, like somebody standing there, you know, used to be the cardboard sign. Now it's an iPad. And you know, sometimes there's a translator that goes with me. There's always a handler, like somebody that just kind of shepherds me from one place to another. But like they packed my whole day, they scheduled it perfectly. Cause I got into Amsterdam at like 5 o'clock, I think it was like 5:23 or something in the morning. And they gave me like the whole day to just relax, which was awesome. Cause then I could just kind of sleep and get used to local time. And yeah, you know, I slept until like around 1 o'clock, and then I wandered around Amsterdam and tried to get into the Anne Frank house, which apparently you need reservations for. And then the next day, like they just booked me solid with interviews, like literally like one after the other, you know, like 1 hour for each one. I probably did like 15 of them or something between the 2 days.
Wow.
But yeah, like the whole thing was just perfectly scheduled out, which was great. It's all like, I mean, if you're going to take a trip like that, like you want it to be that way, you know, you don't want a whole lot of, you know, downtime or just sitting around.
Yeah.
Cool.
But that was fun. Yeah. Kevin, you had some news too, right?
Yeah.
Didn't I see you in a magazine?
Not nearly as exciting as someone fainting in front of me, but I,
it'll happen.
So I got a spotlight about me in the November-December issue of Writer's Digest, but right now on their homepage, They have me featured, my photo and everything, and a nice little article, a nice little interview with me. So if you are tooling around writersdigest.com right now, you can go find
Kevin's
that
face.
article. My face, that I'm getting a lot of play out of that headshot, man.
That's
Things going
great.
everywhere. So yeah, I was really excited about that. And what's funny is, like, we end up talking in today's interview. We starts off talking about Writer's Digest, so it's kind of a nice little circle.
Yeah.
Cool. Are you
So,
guys all ready for Author Nation?
oh man,
Yeah, I'm just
couple
hoping my
days and we're on.
flight doesn't get delayed or canceled.
Yeah,
Fingers crossed.
yesterday someone mentioned it, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be there. That's in like a month or so, right? And they're like, it's
Next
next
week.
week.
Yep.
Like, oh Jesus, I don't think I am ready for it, but
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Well, I'll be
Yep.
there in our Writers Inc. hoodies. Yes, we
I've
will.
got my Writer's Inc. I wasn't going to say anything about the Writer's Inc. hoodie. I was just going to show up and see if you guys remembered, but I've got mine set aside.
Cool.
I totally forgot until you guys started talking about it. I got to take that out and put it on the suitcase or something before I
Well,
end up leaving it here.
specifically were why I wasn't going to say anything. I wanted us to all show. In fact, I was going to coordinate with the ladies. We were all going to show up, and then you weren't going to have yours.
I
I
just got done explaining how I need a handler to figure all this stuff out. Like, you guys
That's
need to
right.
help me here.
Yeah.
I'm worried about getting stuck in Vegas. Like, I've got a feeling we're gonna get out there and then, like, air
Oh,
traffic
we're gonna have a
controller's
good
gonna
time
go
if we get
away.
stuck in Vegas with nothing to do. I will find us something to do.
It's lots to do.
Vegas
That
rules.
is not a bad sit. Well, can be a bad city to get stuck in. I guess it all
I
depends
guess,
on your
yeah.
levels of self-control. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm moving in with
Yeah,
Jenna.
you guys are great, but I can only take so much. I'd probably rent a car and head home. Do
Yeah.
a
Fair enough.
monster
We
road
could do it
trip.
together. We'll do a whole planes, trains, and automobiles thing coming back
Yeah,
from Vegas.
I'll drop you on the way to Texas.
Will you drop me off too? No.
In Canada.
Yeah.
I need my flying car, damn it.
We could resolve all this if they would just take on my proposal of travel by catapult. All we gotta do is
Yeah.
load up, fling us across the country.
That might be what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Might as well these days.
All right. What is in the news?
Well, in the news, first up, read a book, feed a neighbor. For November, author J. Kyle Turner, which is suspiciously close to J. Kevin Tomlinson, I'm just gonna say, is aiming to turn ad spend into meals. Here's the idea. Authors pledge to donate their November royalties to food banks in any proportion the author chooses to the food bank of the author's choice. Readers buy the book, and their purchase benefits not only themselves with a great new book to read, but also folks needing food assistance. You can join by going to the link in the show notes.
I just thought this was so nice. Such a nice
That is pretty
idea for
nice.
November. Support your community and
We JKTs, if we're nice folks,
yeah, it's
we like
great.
to
Like,
take
yeah.
care of people. So
It's kind of making me hungry.
Wow. Oh
You're kind of
my
missing the whole point, JD. But all right.
Yeah.
Next up, new email scam alert. Heads up, there's a scam email impersonating Ingram Spark linking to a site called Ingram Spark Publishers. I've gotten this email. I didn't realize it was a scam at the time. So, or Ingram Spark Book Publishing Services. It looks legit, but it is not affiliated with Ingram. They pitch pricey marketing packages. The real Ingram Spark is free to use for distribution and does not sell these packages. Protect yourself. Double check the URL. Don't pay for unsolicited, quote, Ingram services, and report the messages as phishing. I think that's good advice anyway, Ingram or otherwise. If anyone ever approaches you offering to do marketing for you for money, it's probably 99% a scam, and
Absolutely.
one
So
percent definitely a
my
scam.
emails from Ingram actually go to spam to begin with. So I'm not sure I would
Yeah.
even get caught up in this.
Yeah. But I think it's a good rule of thumb. If someone reaches out to you for marketing, book clubs, anything where they're asking for
Agents.
money, it's
Yeah.
probably a scam. Yeah.
I have a personal rule these days of anything I get that is alerting me that might, especially if it has some kind of financial impact, I walk away from the email and I go directly to their site to see if I've got like a notification on the site. So like PayPal and all that. Anything that people have traditionally used for scamming, I don't even bother. I don't click on links in emails, is I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah. the book club ones are getting good. They have like meetup sites and they have like, you know, thousands of users on their meetup. But if you see their actual meetups, there's maybe 3 to 5 people going to each meetup.
I know, yeah.
So if you see someone with like thousands or tens of thousands of meetup people, but there's no one going to the meetings, that's a scam. Watch out.
Yeah. I get a lot of those. And I always start, if I respond at all, I respond with, you know, thanks for reaching out. Always have to be a part of a reading group. But I do not do pay to play. So if there's any charge for this, I'm not your guy. And it's really funny how they will bend over backwards trying to convince me otherwise. Like they will.
I don't even open them. Like I right click delete because I.
Well, that's because you don't like torturing people as much as I do.
I don't. No.
So I.
Do you know that you're actually talking to a real person, or could there be an AI on the other end of that?
Could be a bot.
I feel pretty confident that I could identify a bot if I'm having a conversation. I feel 100% confident that I could spot it, and I will take money on anybody. I will offer $100 to anybody who can fool me with an AI.
Do you ask them to say potato? Sorry, that's a deep cut. To shout out to Lukey on Instagram there.
But we don't ever have any actual conversations. It's always via email. And it's always like this, you know, go and I have this massive reader group and, you know, you've never heard of it. You know, there's 3 people who show up on it, whatever. Anyway, final story, Diversion Audio to launch James Patterson podcast. James Patterson is launching a weekly interview podcast, Hungry Dogs, on October 29th via Diversion Audio, expanding his Substack video series. Guests span books, music, film, TV, politics, and sports with a strong focus on established and emerging authors. Hello, James. Yeah. Giving Patterson a platform to spotlight new books. Patterson says podcasting is another way to get people to pay attention to stories. Diversion Audio and partner Gemini 13 will handle marketing and brand sponsorship. And I would just like to take this time to say, James, I've always thought you were amazing. Can't wait to talk to you.
I mean, these are always good. I don't have you actually watched or listened to any of the his interviews?
Yeah,
like he gets so excited, you know, like the people that he's talking to. Like he gets really into it, and he gets some really cool guests.
He does what there's a YouTuber who I follow who talks about YouTube and podcasting, and he would call what James Patterson does grandpa vlogging. But he doesn't use it. It's not a negative thing. He actually thinks it's what's right now. It's the hot way to do vlogging. So very authentic. People like that.
Like you're sitting around the fireplace telling stories.
Is it because your grandpa's supposed to be like enthusiastic?
It's because the people who started doing this first were these old timers who just, you know, started talking to their phone and didn't bother with microphones or lights or, you know, anything fancy. But now it's kind of become a little more genericized to a very kind of, I don't know, folksy, nothing polished about it. So I've been doing grandpa vlogging all along is what I'm saying.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Grandpa vlogging.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right. I guess with that, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Orson Scott Card coming on. He's the author of numerous international bestsellers, including Shadow of the Giant and Ender's Game. He's won the Hugo and Nebula Awards. He also has multiple books on craft and teaches English at the Southern Virginia University. He's basically a staple in the industry, and we frankly just wanted to pick his brain a little bit. Here he is, Orson Scott Card.
I'm going to tell you straight up that this is actually the most challenging interview I've ever conducted. Because this is somebody that I have followed for, you know, all my career and a big chunk of my life. And we just spent probably a good 30 minutes before the call started talking to Orson Scott Card. What do I call you? I didn't even ask what I should.
Oh, yeah. I assume that I'm calling you Kevin.
You can call me Kevin.
And you call me Scott.
All right.
And if we get confused about that, it means we're communicating well.
We're going to trade names in the middle of the interview, just to mix things up. As I said, I've followed you for years. I know a lot of your backstory. There's probably things that you could reveal that I've never encountered. But I've read every author's note, every bio about you, your Wikipedia page, all of it.
Well, the Wikipedia page.
Yeah, I know.
It had so many errors, just flat out wrong information.
Yeah.
And I tried to correct it, and I was immediately overridden by some moron who deleted all my changes. And I thought, why are you trying to change where I went to high school? You know, why?
Well, you didn't cite your sources, Scott.
Yeah. Personal knowledge.
Personal knowledge.
It's like the early days of Prodigy.
Yeah,
where they tried to make you stick to the topic, and so somebody would write on a topic devoted to me and my work. Where is Card doing a signing? And if I wrote, I'm going to be appearing at such and such, it would get deleted by the censors at Prodigy. I had to write about myself in the third person before it was considered to be on topic. I just thought that was hilarious.
That tracks. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, you can talk about yourself in first person for this one.
I prefer it that way.
One of the things we love to do is we want to get the writer's origin story. And you've got, you know, I know your origin story, but for the listeners at home, how did you actually get into this illustrious career of yours?
Well, you know, the matter of writing, my dad was sort of a closet wannabe writer. He'd written one short story. I basically know what it was. It was science fictional in a way, a thriller, really. But my mom talked about it. He didn't. He never said a word. But she talked about this story of his. And he subscribed to Writer's Digest. I had Writer's Digest in the house from earliest childhood. And he never let it lapse. So yeah. I never had to trouble with that until I moved out. And so I grew up with that part of the ambience. And I read constantly and lots of things. I graduated to chapter books very young, and I didn't know I was reading material too old for me. When William Shirer, don't know how to pronounce his names, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich came out, I didn't realize how new it was, but it was barely out in paperback when my older sister was required to read it in high school. And I was, I think, 10. And she handed it to me and said, I read this. It's a brilliant, wonderful book. I think you'll love it. I was not prepared to read history that broke my heart.
Yeah.
There were a couple of chapters in there that left me sobbing on my bed where I was reading. I was too young at age 10 to deal with the evil of the Third Reich.
Yeah.
She was actually too young at 16. But I don't blame her for giving it to me. She knew that I could cope, and I did, you know, but at the root of all my storytelling is the memory of that pain. You know, I watch television a lot. I sit in my lazy boy and watch things go by. And the stations that I watch have all kinds of PSAs from St. Jude's, loveshriners.org, I think it is. And Easter Seals. Easter Seals especially gets to me because I had a son with cerebral palsy. He died at 17. And this isn't because I'm old. This is I'm emotional because I miss him every day.
Yeah.
And he never spoke a couple of words, but he was never able to say it again. He communicated with us very well. But I look at those kids in the Easter Seals thing, and I think, if only Charlie could have done that. If only Charlie could have spoken like that or walked like that or ridden that bike. So that one's hard. But then all of the, you know, Wounded Warriors, Tunnel to Towers, I'm crying half the time I'm watching. I feel like I'm never doing enough. I've contributed to all of them.
Yeah.
But I'm not rich. In case you didn't know this, most of us, writing doesn't make us rich.
Yeah.
And
I've been clued in.
I figured you probably knew. Because besides the fact that you're not paid as much as people think, you never know how much it's going to be. You have nothing you can count on. We'll go 1 year and all of a sudden, at the end of one royalty period, we'll discover that Ender was not working as hard as he should have been. And he did not produce as much income for my family as we needed. And then I have to actually write something and fulfill a contract and get paid. So even though I get nice royalties, all my books are in print. My publisher is wonderful. Tom Doherty at Tor saw to it that all my books have remained in print, and so that they can be ordered, they can be bought. And so there's a steady income stream, and there's lots of foreign sales as well. So I'm not complaining. I am doing well, but it's maddening to not know how much money you're going to have each May and each
Has that been the case
November.
since the start? I mean, what
Well,
even.
not from in the start. I had no royalties at all.
Well,
It took a
yes,
long time
right.
before I had a book earn out. So, and in those days, the normal amount for a novel was $3,000 advance. Well, even in that era, $3,000 was a month. When Edgar Rice Burroughs was paid $3,000 for a serialized version of a book in one of the magazines, that was enough that you could live in Manhattan and keep a carriage. That was a year in Manhattan with a carriage.
I can barely afford our carriage now.
The idea of actually owning a horse. Oh, what a nightmare. Because they want to eat even when you don't feel like riding.
That's right. At least you can park the car and it's not demanding more
Yes,
gas.
and but when I was starting out, I didn't plan to be a writer. That wasn't an ambition. That was just something that happened. My mom had been involved in the writing and production of a musical when she was young. Her brother had written the music for the songs. Her mom had written the songs and the script. It was just in the family. And then being Mormon, we had back when I was young, this was a constant thing. Now it's much less common, but we put on road shows. Every congregation in the diocese, the stake, we call it, would put on a 10-minute show that used, without paying royalties in the old days. Nowadays, the royalties are prepaid by the church. But we would take songs and write new lyrics for them and write funny little 10-minute shows. And usually, most of the cast was teenagers or younger. But sometimes you'd get adults in it, and my family was always involved in that kind of thing. We were a theatrical family, not career, but it felt like a career because it was the community we lived in, and it would you could become a star in the theater program of your local ward, and so I took part in that and wrote some road shows in high school, sophomore class assembly. I wrote that. Because nobody else wanted to, and why not? And it was fine. I did. It was a good show. People laughed at the right places. It's always important that they laugh at the right places. So I felt like I could do that. When I got to Brigham Young University, they had an active theater program with one act plays. Everybody who graduated had to have taken the directing class and direct 1 half-hour play, and two a night, once a week, they would. Put them on. And so even before I actually got there, I went to Brigham Young High School, which was attached to the university for my final year of high school. And so I was up there all the time. I was trying out for plays and getting in them because I do great tryout. I'm not a good actor, but I read naturally. And so I get parts. The directors never fired me. They could have. And so I must have done okay, but never starred. Turns, but I directed for not just that one act. I thought that's not enough. I want to learn how to direct, And you don't do that in one half hour play. So I directed for almost every class I took in my theater major. And then after I put on a play for that class, then the faculty would decide that you could no longer put on plays for that particular course. And they had to keep banning everything I did after the fact, until after I graduated, they revised the whole program to be exactly the one that I had devised for myself. I felt very proud of that. But in working
sort of
with,
a subversion method of,
well, it was, and
of
I and I changed
education.
And it became what it had not been, a good theater program where you could actually direct play after play after play. But it's not enough to just direct them, because I was never happy with the script I was given. Even when it was a brilliance, you know, you don't have to do anything to The Importance of Being Earnest. It is a perfect play.
Yeah.
With Neil Simon, I detested his use of God and swearing, not because I'm not offended by the F-bomb. It doesn't bother me. But bother, you know, and the S word and all the other things that we have to circumlocute for public consumption. But just in The Out-of-Towners, when Sandy Dennis, the running gag is all the time she goes, "Oh my God." And I had to practically cover my ears. I hated that so much. It destroyed the comedy for me. But you don't have to rewrite Neil Simon to make him funny. If you're doing The Odd Couple, you're working with the best comic script ever written by an American.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't mess with those things. So when I directed a play from one of the plays in Plaza Suite, had a good cast, and it was a brilliant comedy, the final play in the trilogy, and it went over really well. My directing was going great, but I was also doctoring plays.
Yeah.
I was assistant director to the faculty member who directed Flowers for Algernon. And I loved that story. I had read it as a kid, and it moved me. I'd read the novel and realized that you can take a really good short story and make a mediocre novel out of it, which is a warning, I think, to people who actually write short stories. But the play was dreadful because the adapters had no idea how to handle Smart Charlie. It's what do you do if you want to show somebody smart? Well, in Hollywood, you give them an English accent, which is stupid. And the English are no smarter than Americans. Well, come to think of it, that's not necessarily true. But it's just maddening that nobody, and the actors didn't know how to do it either. We had a good actor playing Charlie, but he was brilliant in the retarded Charlie part and quite not in the smart Charlie part. So I asked the director, "Can I write a new second act for you?" Instead, it was a two act. "Can I write a better second act?" And he said, "Give it a try." So I did. We put on mine. That violated the contract. The statute of limitations is over. So I'm not worried about revealing that, but it violated the contract with the publisher. But I felt satisfied that I knew how to write the second act of Flowers for Algernon better than the other guy who adapted it. I took a novel called Tell Me That You Love Me, Junie Moon by Marjorie Kellogg. I now know that I didn't even completely understand the book. There were things that sailed clear over my naive little head. But I wrote a reader's theater script to that. And I had a standing ovation at the end when it was performed, and people rushing the stage, weeping. And man, that is heady stuff for this 17-year-old kid. So I thought, I can write. And I remember one faculty member really annoyed with me. We were in a group conversation, and he said, "Well, Card, you're going to be a playwright. You're going to be a writer." And I said,
Just a
"No,
given.
no, Dr. Metten. I am a writer. I'd had five plays produced at that college. I've been paid royalties. They even paid me royalties for one of them. And I'm not going to be a writer just because I'm in college doesn't mean I haven't already started my career. And he mocked me. I later overheard him in a class that he didn't know I was in, mocking me and saying, except for, of course, Orson Scott Card, who is a writer. And, I just thought, okay, great. By all means, publicize
That's
my
right. It's
accomplishment.
all the confirmation you need.
It was, but I also knew that you can lose a lot of money putting on plays. I got home from my mission in Brazil and I started a theater company that performed at a place the Works Progress Administration in the Depression built a stone amphitheater on the hill above the State Mental Hospital in Provo, Utah. No one had ever used it. I mean, for one thing, where are you going to park all the cars at the State Mental Hospital? How are you going to get them all up the hill? We solved all those problems, and I put on 2 summers of repertory theater up there. A couple of original plays of mine, but mostly, we did Camelot one time, and there are other musicals I would have liked to do. But I found out that you can have sold-out houses, packed houses, and lose money. And this was with unpaid actors. This was with volunteer actors. And so, it's one of those things where I realized, and I ended up in debt because of things that we didn't do anything expensive, but you still have to pay people for things. And so I owed about $1,000. To end a season owing about $1,000 means there was a huge success in theater, but I didn't have the $1,000. How was I going to get money? At that time, I was working as an editor at the Brigham Young University Press. Where was I going to find money? Editors get paid in small bags of dirt, not fertile dirt. It's Utah dirt, and so it's mostly stone. But I took this idea that I had thought of after reading the Foundation Trilogy. My brother and his soon-to-be wife gave me Foundation and Second Foundation for my birthday. They didn't understand there was that the real second volume was Foundation and Empire, and Second Foundation was the third book. An insane publishing decision, nevertheless. They couldn't very well have called it Third Foundation, so given the story. So I read that, and it's one of those cases where I go, oh man, that was so powerful. I wonder if I could write science fiction. And that had been years before my mission. And I had a story idea about how you train people to fight in three-dimensional space. You can't train them in a place where they're going to end flying off into space and be irretrievably lost. So you had to enclose the space. So I invented the battle room and battle school as a training ground for soldiers. And I had that story floating around in the back of my mind for years. Developing, getting more ideas of how it would work. But then finally, it dawned on me at the very time that I was desperately in need of money that you don't train people for three-dimensional combat starting when they're already adults and have all their bad habits. It's like learning a language. If you want somebody to speak like a native, you make sure they learn it from natives at the age of 7, not the age of 17. Because at 17, you'll never shed your accent. But at 7, you'll sound like a native all your life. And so I thought if you can get kids in 3D space, you can train them to think in 3D space, which makes them fit to command, to not be suckered the way that. And I had read Nordhoff and Hall's, I can never remember the title, but their account of the Lafayette Escadrille. In France, the pilots who would go up and in World War I were when combat, air combat was new. And somebody made the comment to a new recruit, when you first go up and you first get in combat, you're probably going to die because you'll be doing what you do here on land. You'll look to the left and you'll look to the right to see if anybody's coming. But the guy who kills you is going to be coming up from below you and behind you. Or above you and behind you, you'll have no idea he's there. He'll come out of the sun. He'll come out of the clouds. and you won't have known he was there, and poof, all of a sudden there he is, and you're dead. And I thought, okay, that's what combat in 3D is going to be like. So you got to train your commanders to do that. But if you do it when they're children, and that's when I realized that my characters were children, and I decided on a character who had just been given command of his first army, and he was unusually young for that, 9 years old instead of 12, and everybody in his army was the rejects of all the other armies. And that I a girlfriend of mine at the time, her boss ordered her, as condition of employment, to take his kids to the circus in Salt Lake City. We lived 40 miles south in Orem, Utah at the time. And she wanted adult company along with his kids. And so I came along with her, but there was no ticket for me to go into the circus, which is fine because I hate circuses. I always did. I hate clowns. I hate the whole thing, mostly because I'm an acrophobe and so much of it takes place in the air. And if they're I'm grateful when there's a net. There was at the Salt Palace in Salt Lake City a net for the acrobats, the one I went to long before. But so I sat on the lawn outside the Salt Palace in Salt Lake City, and I opened my notebook. The way that I wrote all my plays was in longhand on paper, and I wrote, "Remember, the enemy's gate is down." Because that's the beginning of the idea of how you orient yourself in three-dimensional space. You have to have it down. Your brain requires it. So that seemed to me to be obvious. That's the only line from the short story that survives in the novel. But that was in 1975. And I thought, this is a good story when I was done, that this
I own at
works.
least two t-shirts with that phrase on it
And then people make you stop so they can read the words and then go, "What's that about?" Anyway,
somewhere.
so but see that I was not a science fiction writer. I had read enough science fiction so as not to embarrass myself, but I was not a quote fan unquote. I didn't know what the science fiction convention, World Science Fiction Convention, even was, or how voting would ever take place. I had never read a story in a science fiction magazine. I had only read anthologies, and so I was totally naive, except that I had read enough of those anthologies that I didn't try to reinvent the wheel like Margaret Atwood did. I mean, you read *Handmaid's Tale* and you go, "Oh, this person's never read science fiction in her life. She hasn't learned how to do exposition the way that Robert Heinlein taught us all how to do exposition, where you just bleed the information in." And so, but I knew how, without even vocalizing, verbalizing the
Did
instruction,
that
I knew how to
become
do it.
instinctive when just through the reading it?
It was absolutely instinctive because I understood point of view, which is actually the most important thing to learn if you're going to write fiction, is how to handle viewpoint. But there were no books that discussed it. They would tell you, they would define first person, third person, second person, but they wouldn't ever tell you why, and why you would choose one over the other, and how to handle the limited third person, and how to penetrate, how to, So when it came time to write a writing book, I chose to write about the thing that no one had helped me learn, because it needed to be done. And so,
That would be character and viewpoint, which I own
right.
multiple copies of for some
Well,
reason.
thank you. The words have not changed, so you can stop buying new ones. But I appreciate sales. But the thing that I didn't understand was how to handle narrative. I mean, I handled viewpoint very naturally, very well. I had grown up on Jane Austen and Margaret Mitchell. And so I had viewpoint from those. But what I didn't have was a knowledge of the original short story of Ender's Game is basically dialogue and stage directions, because I was a playwright. I still am. It's one of the things when people talk about plot, they often say plot when they mean story, because plot is a theatrical term. And it means you have the plot on a piece of paper stapled to the inside wall of one of the set pieces, and you all consult it because it tells you who is on stage at any given time. So I knew how to plot. I knew what I didn't want in the scene, which is what plotting is. And that's how you decide, you know, when idiotic thing that people tell writers, show, don't tell. Have you ever read anything written by somebody who actually was showing you? Well, then he took his left foot and moved it forward. And you know, that's showing how to walk. But you don't do that. You say you got in the car and arrived at the bank in 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have to tell us how to operate the car or show us, you know, show don't tell is crap.
So, okay.
Show the important scenes.
I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about the upcoming books.
I'm not good at promoting myself.
Well, we're going to promote your
talk
book.
About this.
Yeah.
The book that when this airs, I understand the book that's going to be coming out is, I can't even remember now.
Should be.
Is the title Reawakening?
Reawakening, right.
And or that's, is it that's Reawakenings?
It's Reawakening.
Okay,
singular.
Just one. Okay.
Yeah.
The things like that just baffle me. My memory's not good. It never has been.
I'm Ender's glad to hear Game, that actually, because I do the same thing.
Well, in the short story, Ender's Game,
yeah.
His name keeps changing from Wigan to
Wigan
Wiggins.
To Wiggins, I know.
Back and forth. I never even thought of it. I was not aware that I was doing that.
Yeah.
And in the novel, I decided, but then I couldn't remember what I had decided. So it was going back and forth too.
Seems
so,
easier in this day and age of the auto or the,
the automatic
find and replace. All right, well, let's talk about Reawakening, which is book two in your sidestep. I read book one the instant it came out. I've already pre-ordered this one. I'm your guy.
Well,
I've probably single-handedly sold or bought more copies of Ender's Game than any other
living
human.
I have to say that I wish I could return the favor because I sort of dropped out of science fiction as back in the 80s, I read every science fiction short story published.
Yeah.
In magazines and whatever, and published reviews of them in Richard Geiss's Science Fiction Review.
Yeah.
But I burned out.
I hear
totally
you.
Burned out.
No.
You know, you spend 3 years reading every short story and you're done. You've seen everything that
That's
can be
right.
done in science fiction.
That's right.
But
we have
so
not
I'm not.
Seen what has been. I'm
I
steering
have.
You back around. We're going to steer back around to your new book because I want.
Well,
We got to
because
make sure.
I just was apologizing for the fact that you are an amazingly prolific writer. I
Oh, well,
opened
thank you.
One of your novels and immediately was hooked. I mean, you know what you're doing, and I had never heard of you. I
Well,
knew a distant relative of yours, Rick Tumlinson.
Rick Tumlinson,
And that's why when your name showed up, I thought it was him that I was talking about. And so then I find out about you, and then I read your list of publications. My gosh. You know, your list of publications feels like the library card catalog. You've written so much. And if they're all even in the same territory as the book that I just started reading, you're obviously the real thing. And I'm excited to be talking to a writer who
Bless
actually
you.
knows how it's done.
Bless you. That soundbite's going on repeat for my I'm
Yeah,
listening
but
to
you
that
didn't
as an
have to say
affirmation
it.
at
You
night.
didn't have to say it.
Well, let's talk about Reawakening while we've got some time. The first they set up, and I'll let you kind of drive. But I mean, Laz is the main character. He has the
Well,
ability to.
the first book is Wakers, and it's
Wakers is the first
easier
book,
to
right?
read Reawakening if you've read Wakers.
Oh yeah,
But
I
I made
recommend
it a
that.
point in all my sequels that if you've never read the previous book, you
Yeah.
can still understand everything going on in the sequel. So if you start with Reawakening, it'll work.
You've got a unique approach to this because it does involve multiple, you know, a sort of multiverse kind of thing, which Marvel has just wrecked for us. But, you know, the idea of side real universes.
Marvel wrecks nothing because nobody takes it seriously.
I used to,
In the
though. I
world of
used to.
science fiction, we writers of print science fiction rule.
Yeah,
They
I
may not
agree.
know it. The movies are the ones that make all the money, but they have never invented anything.
I agree. But but let's not talk about Marvel. I don't want to, you
No,
know,
that's fine. That's fine. I love
dish on
Marvel.
them too bad.
No, there's nothing to dish about. I think they've done an amazing job.
Well, let's
of making good movies. So anyway,
all right.
Go ahead.
So what's the kind of the rundown for Reawakening? What should we be looking for?
Well, the idea is, for one thing, that people can be revived using the combination of DNA and recorded memories, brain state. We have no idea what intelligence is or memory or anything else. We know that there are locations that stimulate memory in the brain, but whenever anybody talks about artificial intelligence, I just have to laugh. You morons, there is no such thing as artificial intelligence because we don't even know what intelligence is.
Right.
We have no good working definition of it. We don't know how the mind works. When scientists say there's no such thing as the mind, and I go, no, you idiot. We all know what the mind is because we all have one and we use it all the time. So if you say there is no such thing, what that means is you don't know what you're talking about. It's you're defining yourself as an idiot. But anyway, the idea is science fictional premise that you can be revived. But this kid who's revived, Laz, something must be wrong or they wouldn't have revived him. But he didn't even know he had been recorded.
Right.
And so this was all new to him. And so, but he always had the ability to go back and fix stuff. Not by going back in time, but if something went horribly wrong, he could find a reality in which that had not happened.
Yeah.
And then step into that reality. If he was already there in, you know, in that other reality, he would simply inhabit his own body, but bring with him the memories that he had from the previous existence. And so we watch him work through memories of people that he knew, and then he finds another person who is in his clone mill. And her name is Ivy, and she can see the other realities. She can't step, but she can see them better than he does. And so together they make quite a team. And that's what goes on in Wakers. And it's really mostly a personal story for them. But Reawakening, they have saved the human race by moving us off the Earth before it plunges into the sun because of a wandering planet whose gravity screws everything up.
Yeah.
He finds a reality in which that planet has not shown up. And then he has to, and that world they create basically 7 or 8 Earths, I can't remember the number, which can be divided up. They were uninhabited. He found an uninhabited Earth, but one which had vegetation and some animal life. And so people from old Earth are all evacuated through the gates that he creates to the new world.
Yeah.
But groups that hate each other go to different versions. So they're not there to bother each other. What matters to me is that in Reawakening, people still find ways to hate each other.
Yeah.
And to try to be imperialist, to try to force their will on others. And the climax of the book is centered around an attempt to invade the central world, if there is a central world of these, from one of the other worlds. And we get an October 7th style atrocity that starts off this invasion. That kind of thing is a declaration of war, of course.
Right.
And the response to it needs to be and must be devastating and final because that cannot be tolerated in a civilized world.
Yeah.
You know, it's the lesson we learned from the Assyrians.
Right.
That it's one thing to conquer and get people to pay you tribute, but it's another thing when you tolerate rebellion. Your empire falls apart, your economy collapses. And so the Assyrians, they didn't slaughter everybody who rebelled. They just picked them up and moved them to another country where they did not belong, where they had to learn new skills. It's ruthless, it's Machiavellian, and it worked.
Yeah.
The Assyrian Empire was amazing, and all empires afterward followed their model. The difference is that Rome did just kill everybody. They didn't move people. And you make a desert and you call it peace was what they were told, and it was true. It was Beni Vidi Vici or Weenie Weedy Weeky, the new pronunciation, which was supposedly the old. Anyway, I'm really proud of the book Reawakening because it also deals with them exploring their abilities and finding crazy stuff happen. Anyway, I was getting to some point on there, but maybe I already got there and didn't notice when it happened.
I think we've covered a lot of territory, and I have to wrap up, which is unfortunate for me, but
Well,
just the
it's
rules of
fortunate for
the
your listeners.
But the book is Reawakening. It's book two in a trilogy, and we hopefully will see a third book. But the book's coming out on November 11th, 2025, and it's already available for pre-order on Amazon and elsewhere.
Now, let me. This is 2025 right now, right?
It is currently
Okay, so
2025,
I
but
have
that's
no internal calendar.
no, I hear
You
you.
don't.
No, I hear you. I have to throw the date in just because who knows when anybody's going to be listening to this,
That's
but
right. If they're listening to this 12 years from now, they'll know that you're describing your future, their past.
that's right. Well, Mr. Card, Orson Scott Card, one of my literary heroes. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Well, I hope that now I'm a literary friend, as
You're,
I think of
I am
you as a literary friend.
absolutely
So
willing to say that. So
thanks.
from now
'Cause
on,
the better you know me, the less you'll think of me as a hero, believe me.
I get that. Yeah, I too am no one's hero. So, all right. Well,
Well,
thank you
in a
very
way, you're
much.
mine. Anyway, I want a bibliography like yours, darn it. Anyway,
All right.
it's great to talk with you.
I have to say that I was beside myself when JD reached out and asked if I wanted to talk to
I
Scott
didn't
because
notice that in the interview at all, Kevin.
No,
there was a
it
lot of
didn't
ass
come
kissing
through.
in this interview, I will say.
I would call it fangirling, but no,
Yeah,
it's
I was
okay.
like, oh, does Kevin know who he's talking to?
Yeah, and that's not my MO because nor I talk to a lot of big name people and it just
You can fangirl.
oh
Right.
yeah I'm totally
Well,
I'm a, I'm I'm in it.
I had to set it up after I saw the shrine in your house.
Yeah, I do have a whole like wing of the house that is nothing but OSC stuff. So he actually said that he hates the phrase show don't tell, which is one we hear a lot, but and he calls it bad advice. What do you think? You agree
I
with
thought
that?
that was really interesting. Yes, to some extent, and also no to some extent. You have to use exposition sometimes, right? Because, you don't want to blow by blow. But I do think exposition is more heavily used in science fiction and to some extent in epic fantasy than other genres. So I do think it's genre dependent.
It is very genre dependent. Like I don't, yeah, if you're talking about like something like a thriller, like you gotta be super careful how much time, you kind of allow for that slower, I guess, pacing. 'Cause no matter how well it's written, I think exposition naturally slows down the pace.
Well, I think I've mentioned before, like when I send out beta reader copies to people, I ask them to highlight any place that they're skimming, and it's always this kind of stuff that gets flagged by people. This is where they put the book down. This is where their mind starts to wander. And I think we all do it, but like I was just going through, this morning I always start by reading what I wrote the previous day, and I found some in there. I just rewrite it. Because sometimes you don't even catch yourself doing it, when you're actually writing it the first go around. But if you go back for a second pass, it usually jumps out.
And sometimes you need to do it just for your own self, like as an author, as you're writing. It's like you need it to kind of help ground you in that scene. But as you edit, those are easy places to really cut down. And
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to put it too, because you might write that, and then like JD says, you come back and excise that, you kill your darlings basically, right? Like you're combing through to find the stuff that was unnecessary. It's like when you're building, if you're building a house, there's a point at which you're framing walls and you're putting them up, and they put these temporary like slanted pieces of wood to hold it in place while they put the rest of the walls up. That's what that is. It's just there to hold it up long enough for you to build the rest of the house.
But I think in sci-fi, like, readers give more grace with that because you need kind of an upfront, in a lot of cases, exposition on the story world to get you in the story. And
Because
that
it's a world you're
might
not familiar with.
Yeah,
exactly.
hard sci-fi for sure. Other, I don't know. I don't know if it's all sci-fi because if you
Not
ever
all
had like
sci-fi, also epic fantasy.
It depends on how alien the world's going to be to the reader.
And I think there's some readers, especially if you're reading hard sci-fi, they like that. And it's a little bit more niche or niche, as you would say.
Niche.
I say niche, but
Correct way to say
they
it.
want the, like you
French.
can't give a the specs of a spaceship in show. And the readers are there for that. They want to think about the what if and would this word drive work
You
and
definitely have to know your reader base and like what they're showing up to that book for. Yeah, because like I actually don't read a whole lot of hard sci-fi for that exact. I
Same.
don't.
Honestly, Ender's Game is a really good example of this because there's very little telling in Ender's Game, and like he's creating a whole world, a whole situation, and he basically just states it as fact, and like you buy it as the reader. And he sneaks in those couple of things that you really need to know here and there. And I think you can do that with just about any story. Like you can even epic fantasy. I think if you circle back and you really approach it, you can find a way to retell that paragraph.
Yeah, I think I heard advice at some point that said with sci-fi and fantasy that if whatever you wrote could stand alone on its own, it's probably too much exposition and to try to find a way to make it dependent on the scene. And I always thought that was really good advice as a way to balance, what you're describing.
I also think there are different kinds of exposition. Like you can do exposition that doesn't feel like exposition. I've probably talked about this before, but my friend was doing an MFA and I made him let me audit it. I'm like, come teach me your MFA. And they did exposition. It was a short story, which I can't remember the name of. It took place in a bathroom. And it was all exposition, but it was so well written,
Saw.
none of it felt like exposition. And I mean, I think some of that is just mastering craft as well. So it's
I agree.
interesting to think about.
It is interesting. I know we're not going to talk about it because I'm the only one that probably zeroed in on this, but I just really wanted to that how cool is the plot comes from theater because you would literally staple to say who was on the stage. That's all. I was like, oh, I love that. I love that nerdy little fact.
So he actually has a book that we mentioned, Characters and Viewpoint. I've read it. I've got, for some reason, I ended up with like three copies of it. I still have them.
Some
But
reason. So it's
for
a
some
mystery
reason,
how.
I don't know how. I think I got one as part of a Writer's Digest book club, and then one I had bought already. I don't know how it all happened. However, I own it. But he talks about how Viewpoint, he sees it as crucial, but a rarely taught skill. How do you get a good point of view? How do you get a good POV? What's helped you kind of master that?
I think the closer you can get, I mean, I don't know. I tend not to write. I don't ever, I think, write in the what is it? Omniscient?
Omniscient, yeah.
I think that that's actually, I don't like reading it. I don't write it. So I think like the closer you can get to
And
a character.
I don't think he means, and in fact, I know he doesn't mean the sort of technical POVs. I think he's really talking about, regardless of how you tell the story, like what POV you choose to write from or what style you write from. I think he means like, how do you decide who's the main point of view in that scene or in that entire book?
You
Like,
know, that's really interesting because
I
I was just thinking about that. I'm reading, oh, I can't even remember what the name of it is. It's a mystery and it's in the style of like Sherlock Holmes. It's kind of like a modern Sherlock Holmes and Fortune Favors the Dead. And so it's a Watson and Holmes type situation. And I was thinking about that. I'm like, why are we telling it through Watson? But Holmes is so intellectual. I don't think readers would connect with that voice. So you've got that more down to earth, everyman relatable voice, which I thought was a smart choice. So those are some of the kind of things that I think about when who's going to tell this story.
Who's the most interesting person?
Who has the most stakes? It's a bit of a balance, right? So, yeah.
I use this thing I call the hierarchy of characters, where I figure out how much screen time each character has in the story. And then if you've got two or three of those people in the same room, whoever's got the largest amount of screen time in the overall novel gets the point of view for that particular scene. Yeah. And I try to stick with that, because to me, it's very confusing if you've got somebody who the reader considers to be the main character, and then all of a sudden you go into a scene with that person, but somebody else, you know, you're in somebody else's head. That never seems to work right. It takes me out of the story. Like, I just finished reading Count of Monte Cristo, and he does that through the whole book.
Yeah.
Like, literally bouncing from head to head to head. Like, and it was driving me insane. Kevin, I completely spaced on that question because I just saw like a giant rat walking behind you.
Oh my
into your office.
You saw a giant rat walking behind. Oh,
yeah.
My tiny little dog.
Your little dog.
Is that what that was? Yeah. I just saw a head really quick and it ducked. Okay.
I didn't realize she'd come up here. Yeah,
we
she's
want
in her.
She needs
her
to
bed.
Be our mascot. Put her on screen. But you know, I was just thinking about that. You know, because I read for other people, and if your character is an observer in that scene, that's not your point of view character usually.
I don't know, because call me
usually,
Ishmael.
There's
right?
always like yeah, there's always exceptions, you know.
Right.
But they're not doing anything. Maybe they're not your point of view character.
So like Ender's Game is the book he's definitely known the most for. But just looking at the rest of the books that are kind of part of that universe, there is he's got a sort of side series with a character named Bean, who is actually smarter, far more brilliant than Ender, but he is an observation character throughout. The only time you only see him a couple times in Ender's Game itself, but in his entire series, he's the outsider looking in and seeing things play out, and he figures out, oh, Ender needs this, he needs to be pushed this way, and he ends up kind of influencing a lot of what happens in the first book. And so it's that idea is that like a secondary character becomes the protagonist in that sense, but he's relaying things, you know, that are happening to other characters.
I guess what I would say to that is he's still active in that perspective, like in that series, he's the one, even though he is observing Ender, hear his thoughts, and
he's consequential.
He's still active, but you need Ender's Game to do that. I think really effectively. So, you know, I've read books where they do that, where it feels like they're conveyed. Like Sherlock Holmes, I guess, is a really good example of that, right? Like, if people haven't read it, they would assume Sherlock Holmes is the main character, and in some ways he is, but really we're getting it through Watson. So it can
Holmes
be done.
Holmes is the subject.
Right. Yeah. And so, but you know, Watson, we're getting his thoughts and his interpretation and his sort of analysis of what's going on, which is kind of an interesting thing. So I guess there's like Christine said, when you're talking about observer, I think it kind of has more to do with action.
Yeah.
Like is the character active in the scene, or are they passive? And if you have a passive main character, then I think Christine point stand is that that's probably not your main character, because even if they're sort of focusing on a different character, they still have to be active in their perspective. Who is the most active? Because that's what's going to engage the reader.
I mean, you think about Gatsby, like it would not have worked if it was told from Gatsby's point of view, because he would not have had any perspective on himself. So,
plus,
yeah,
he's not,
really
he's not very likable.
No.
Sherlock Holmes is the same way, right? Like if this was told from his point of view, those books would be extremely boring, because you get every reveal like immediately. And I mean, the reveals are what make those stories so cool. And the fact that.
Yeah.
You know,
Because Watson doesn't understand him. He's like, what's going on? Oh, and you know,
Right.
and then it's sort of like the brilliance unfolds all at once.
Right.
Yeah. So if you were in his in Sherlock's head the whole time, then you would already know all these things, and you would
Yeah.
know his thought patterns, and it would just the stories would be completely different, and they probably wouldn't have sold a single
Yeah,
copy of
yeah.
those books.
And his
Yeah.
voice is so much more pretentious. I don't think it would be so fun to read either. So
I don't know. I write journals, and people I think are gonna love reading those one day.
Oh
So,
Okay.
but I have one last question, and it's a quick one, I promise. Did we all hear him say all those nice things about me, and how much do we agree with
I have no idea what you're talking about, Kay. I didn't hear
them?
any
We
of
hear
that.
the same interview. I don't
I've
recall
got that clipped. It's my ringtone on my phone.
I was just gonna say you must have made like a greatest hits of these that you just sit down and listen to every day, like as an affirmation
It's
for
the only
40
thing keeps
minutes
me
every
going
morning.
while we downsize.
Yeah.
I just play this
You
over and
just
over
listen
again.
to that interview over and over and over again.
That's what it is.
Oh, that's
So,
yeah,
all
no, that
right,
was
that's it.
very nice of him to say all that about
It
you.
was very nice. I was
Yes.
flattered, and then I rushed to pay him.
Oh,
You take
perfect.
Venmo? Here.
Yeah.
Here's my entire life savings. Thank you so
Okay.
much.
Excellent. With that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got J. Luke Benecke coming on. His debut thriller, Civil Terror Gridlock, won several awards, including first place for Best of Backlist in the 2023 Feathered Quill Awards. He continued the award sweep with his second novel, Waterborne, and his latest, Echo from a Bayou, is doing fantastic as well. We're going to dive into what it takes to build a career as a thriller author in today's complex publishing world.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.
Say potato if you're real.
Hey, you won my first match. A dare to try to make a better first mistake. Serious stuff.